Yes, The Man Who Loved Children by Christina Stead. It was published in 1940 and it was Christina Stead's fifth novel. Now, this Aussie classic isn't set in Australia at all. It's set in Washington, D.C. in the 1930s, but it is based on Christina Stead's own childhood in Sydney, and just how closely it's based we'll find out in just a minute. It takes us inside the four walls of a very dysfunctional family, the Polletts, where the mother and the father, Henny and Sam, are waging an unrelenting battle. They've got six kids together, and then there's the adolescent Louisa, or Louie, who's Sam's child from a previous marriage, and she's a pretty unhappy sort of onlooker in the middle of all this. Now, the book has some very powerful champions, including the British writer Angela Carter, the great American poet and critic Randall Jarrell. The American novelist Jonathan Franzen wrote an article in 2010 in which he hailed The Man Who Loved Children as a forgotten masterpiece. I'm convinced, he wrote, that there are tens of thousands of people in this country, the USA he means, who would bless the day the book was published if only they could be exposed to it. So very big claims are made for the quality of this book. Well, I put it in our Australian classic reading list precisely because, well, this is the honest truth, like so many people, I'd never actually read it. And I knew that people made a huge claim for the book. So I thought our reading club was the ideal opportunity to test these claims and to have the opportunity, the excuse, to read the book in detail myself. And I must say, I've enjoyed it. It's a very rugged read and a very bracing one. But I'm so pleased that I chose it. But you may not be. What about you? Do you remember the impact it had when you read it, perhaps at school or uni? Did it excite you? Did it appall you? We do want to know what you think. Call us on 1300 22 55 76. That's 1300 22 55 76. And if you're in the Northern Territory or in South Australia, you'll have to call us right away to beat that time difference. That's 1300 22 55 76. You can also tweet us. So use the hashtag RN Book Club. Or you can text. So the text number is 0418 22 65 76. 0418 22 65 76. Well, my two guests have read it. Let's find out what they think. Fiona Morrison joins us. She's a lecturer in the School of English Media and Performing Arts, the school of just about everything that matters, really, at the University of New South Wales. She has an Australian Research Council grant to explore Christina Stead in America. Hi, Fiona.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. When did you read The Man Who Loved Children?
It's really wonderful to be asked that question. I think it was the second year of university and my first year of doing Australian literature, although the book had always been on Mum's bookshelf. So it had been in my life sort of visually for a while.
And what university was that at?
That was the University of Sydney.
So at the University of Sydney, it was on the reading course?
No, I don't think that's right. Ah. I think it was just the time that I thought, right, well, I've got to read The Man Who Loved Children, because even in those days I had a sense in which it was important. Yes, but I'm not sure where from.
No, it was a book people were talking about when I was at uni too. I can remember it being a book that was kind of in the zeitgeist. So what was your reaction?
Well, it's great to remember this now, because many things have changed in my views about Stead, but this one particular thing was the combination of feeling both profoundly claustrophobic because of being so up close to this enormous kind of struggle, this epic struggle between these three characters, but also kind of released into this huge creative vision. It was a contradiction, really, claustrophobic in one sense and extraordinary vistas of language and vision on the other.
Well, it's got something to do with what literature can do, doesn't it? That this word literature, which sometimes sounds so precious, is actually about language that can take you to another level of reality, that has a kind of dimension to it.
Yes.
And that's what you're finding here.
Yeah, well, that amazing. I mean, it's an enormously substantial book, substantial in a way that almost doesn't get tried now, I think. It's not even attempted now. There's something about Stead where she felt complete permission to do enormous things on an enormous scope. But here, this fantastic sense of being trapped or of being claustrophobic as well. And I think that is about permission, the scope of the vision, but also texture, the texture of the language that she uses, which is not highbrow necessarily, but it's enormously substantial.
Mm. Now, also with us is Daryl Emerson, who's a writer and performer. His play about Christina Stead's life was called I Write What I See, Christina Stead Speaks. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Michael.
So you performed that back in 2010?
Yeah, at the Trades Hall in Melbourne.
Yeah, do you remember when you first read it?
The book itself? Yeah. Probably about 20 years ago.
Right. So you were just a young thing.
That's very kind of you. Well, yes, in middle life, let's say.
Right.
Well, it's interesting, a mix of feelings about it. I was impressed with it, but appalled in another way, because being a mild, peaceable person, I was plunged into this brawling, squalling universe, and that was a bit much. But what Fiona says about the freedom with which Stead writes, I think that's a very good point. I mean, when I wrote my play about Christina, I was struck with her devotion to Balzac, and she's often quoted him as a fictional model. I think there's something of that kind of abandon yourself to the spirit of the work feeling in this novel as well. One of Balzac's quotes that she often mentioned was, "It's important not so much to avoid mistakes, but to generate a spirit that sweeps all before it." And I think that's what she does in that book, in The Man Who Loved Children.
Did you find it a tough read that first time?
Yes, I did. I found it quite cruel and quite brutal. And
I mean, it can be tough in two ways, can't it? It can be tough because the world you're being taken into is so wretched and unpleasant.
Mm.
But it can also be tough because there is something about the literature, the literary quality, that is a little bit impermeable or impervious well, I found it at first. I actually found that it took 60 or 70 pages before I thought, oh, I'm getting this now. It's speaking to me. Or did you get into it from page one?
Look, I think I got into it perhaps a bit sooner because, my feelings about her are related to my study of her as a person, and which came later. But she was very influenced by Dostoevsky, and those kind of huge monologues that his characters go into. You kind of go with the arias or you don't, I suppose, from pretty early on.
So darkness and suffering and the contradictions of life, but the contradiction between light and darkness, which I suppose is what Dostoevsky is, that's what you're drawing on there when you make that comparison?
Well, I think the fact that she gives her characters permission to go into huge monologues, quite uninterrupted ones, and when we're rehearsing the play and the words were being spoken now, not just read and on the page, it was quite alarming sometimes in rehearsals, and the audiences reacted very differently. Some people were kind of astounded and thrilled by one particular section of the book. Other people just couldn't wait to leave the room.
Yes. People do have very polarised views about this. Denise from Albury's texted us. She says, it's at least 40 years since I read The Man Who Loved Children, but its intensity and colourful of language and lives remains with me. Yes, it's one of those books that really does change the kind of fabric of your imagination, doesn't it? Trying to fit in a rereading, said Denise. Brilliant novel. Yes, I mean, it is tough. You're undertaking a big task, Fiona, when you sit down and read it, aren't you?
Yes, you are, yeah, certainly. I mean, just every time I come back to it, it reminds me in this way of Wuthering Heights, and Bronte's an interesting comparator, along, of course, quite rightly, Daryl's quite right, with Dostoevsky and Balzac, where you have a memory of where things are in the book, if you know the book at all, and then you come back and they're not there, they're later or earlier, or it's a slightly TARDIS effect.
Mm.
The boiling down of the Marlin, for example, and that's much later. And so it's a very, there's something about the intensity of the read if you give it yourself over to the rhythms of the book. And I've just been contemplating the deep theatricality of those monologues, and it's interesting to think about it in theatrical space. But you have to, in a sense, surrender. And I think it's a polarising book, not only because of its unrelentingness of its kind of French objectivity or its aims for that, I think also because you have to surrender into rhythm and to a lot of speech, which we're not used to as much these days, I don't think.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and you're on the Australian Classics Book Club because it's the last Friday of the month, and we're reading The Man Who Loved Children. And you can call us if you're in South Australia or the Northern Territory. You need to call pretty much now. That's 1300 22 55 76, 1300 22 55 76 if you'd like to talk to us online. If you're a bit more shy, you can text us 0418 22 65 76, 0418 22 65 76 to text us, or you can even tweet us using the hashtag RN Book Club. Fiona, when did it achieve some kind of status as an Australian book? I know there's a plaque dedicated to Christina Stead in Sydney's Writers' Walk around Circular Quay that honours the great Australian writers. When did she kind of gain a place in the pantheon?
In Australia, particularly, is the question. Yeah. It's a very interesting question about her status in Australia. It, broadly speaking, you know, if you take out a couple of people who probably had the idea that she was important and good before 1965, it, like Ron Gearing, for example, at UNSW, who was publishing bits of her in Southerly in the early 60s, 62, 63, really Australia followed the worldwide about-face on Stead following the reissue of The Man Who Loved Children in 1965. Prior to that, there'd been strange and varied reviews of her work. We were typically only very much interested in those books set in Australia, and she had also her book Letty Fox, published 1946, had come under the eye of the censors in Australia. So she was offering up quite a lot of difficulty to Australian literary critics, who were much more interested generally in a kind of project of cultural nationalism, and it's about us and it's about here. And but after Jarrell's introduction and a sense in the world market, meaning, of course, you know, England and North America, that here was something very important. We followed suit, and the signs of that are both that she started to be worked on in academic circles, but also published here by Angus and Robertson. Mm.
So in the 1965 edition, there was this rave introduction by the American poet Randall Jarrell, who's a man of immense standing. He'd edited anthologies and written books and so on. And he doesn't praise it as an Australian book. He's an American. He doesn't praise it as an Australian book. He just praises it as a work of literature. It's a kind of international achievement.
Yes. That's the most striking, one of the many, many striking things about Jarrell's introductory essay to the 65 reissue, which had been a fight really waged by Stanley Burnshaw since about 1961 to get Holt Reinhardt to get it out, because he was appalled by how poor Stead and her partner Blake were in England. And it's a very long essay, the sort of length that we don't see now either, and a passionate championing of Stead. Essentially, I think we would see it now as a world writer in the category of a universally great world writer like Dostoevsky or Tolstoy or Faulkner or a range of English writers, British writers. So he places her not at all in an Australian canonical position. Doesn't read her or her life as being related at all to Australia. Except he has reservations about her grasp of American idiom, very slight reservations.
Let's come to that issue a bit later on. We might get to that. Look, we should hear from Christina Stead. She's got a remarkable voice. Here she is in a 1976 interview explaining, well, what she has to say about writing the book.
The Man Who Loved Children I did in the centre of New York, in a rather dark apartment where we were overshadowed by what they call loft buildings, which are high-rises with factories on one floor. They're called lofts. We were overshadowed by these lofts, and it was really rather a dreary sort of place, although they had an Italian garden, so-called, downstairs and all that. But I was rather unhappy at that moment. Nothing special, I think. It was being cooped up in all this stonework and brickwork. And I decided to get that off my chest. It was, and that was all it was.
It's an amazing voice, isn't it? Christina Stead interviewed back in 1976 talking about the novel. Well, I guess one way to tackle this is to go through the characters. There's a huge cast of characters in the Pollitt family and the extended family. So let's take them one by one. So we've got Sam Pollitt. Now, Sam is the patriarch, often referred to as a monster by critics. He is the man who loves children. Darryl, what do you make of Sam?
Well, Sam is a charismatic, domineering, possessive kind of parent, I think. I think he's got some pretty strange ideas of women and of marriage and of parenthood. In one chapter, he basically confesses to Louisa that he got married to her, to the stepmother, simply because he wanted to have a lot of children who would admire him and look after him. So that's a few clues to Sam's modus operandi, I think. And the relation between Sam and David Stead is probably another whole program, but certainly Sam comes across as a magnetically attractive character, at least in his own mind, certainly one who dominates the lives of those around him, and then in a way tries to escape the consequences of his egotism, I think.
Mm. Immensely clever with language.
Yes, I mean, there's all sorts of things about that. I think in Hazel Rowley's excellent book, which I can't praise too highly.
This is her biography.
That's right, terrific book. Some of the speeches attributed to Sam in the book were actually, I think, taken from letters written by David Stead to his daughter Christina, and they're kind of rather gooey, irritating, full of baby talk, affectionate, sort of quasi-erotic, semi-seductive stuff between a father and a daughter.
Oh, you make it sound very, very icky.
Well, it is. It is. That's just, and kind of more than icky, sort of suspect. I think there's all sorts of, without going into another area, all sorts of psychological undercurrents in the book, because I think the book is part of the reason, going back to another question away from Sam slightly, the book is partly about abuse, I think, really, in modern terms, in modern psychological terms, along with just an unhappy family.
Would you go along with that, Fiona?
Yes, I think so. I mean, and I too admire Rowley's book, and I find it enormously useful to have that as a resource. I'm less completely comfortable all the time with reading Stead biographically, although she herself said, if you want to know about my life, read my books. But I mean, in the way that Wuthering Heights is also a study of trauma and abuse and, in a sense, imprisonment. I think she talked about being deeply etched by her childhood, and I think it is a record of that, but not just as sort of family politics. I think there's a wider political point she's making about children as a kind of vulnerable category in the Commonwealth of this house. Yep.
Are you uncomfortable about reading it autobiographically because that's your position on novels in general, or because you think there's some problem with doing that with this particular book?
No, I mean, I'm just slightly wary with the kinds of readings that biographical readings shut down. I'm very happy for biographical readings, autobiographical readings, to coexist with other readings, as long as just going to the life and reading the book to the life doesn't shut down other sorts of questions or possibilities or thoughts or theories.
I think there can be something a bit reductionist about those linking a book directly to the life of the author, because I think in my own impression of The Man Who Loved Children, this is a quick summary of the autobiographical part, is that some of it is autobiographical, some of it, I think, her own imagination and inventiveness swept her away, and I think a lot of it neither we nor even Christina Stead herself could say whether it was directly linked to the life behind it.
She does say, though, that she wrote it to get something off her chest.
I think it was cathartic. I think that's true. And I think in some ways she'd reached a point, both in her life and in her writing, when something, a more personal kind of book, was now the thing to do, because some of her first few books were quite brilliant and exploratory and more objective in the way she said she was all the time. But with this one, some impulse led her to look more closely, whether accurately or in a very imaginative way, with her early life.
Mm. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and we're looking forward to your calls. Call us on, you can text us on 0418 22 65 76, 0418 22 65 76, or call on 1300 22 55 76, 1300 22 55 76. And tell us whether you think this should have a more prominent place in the Australian literary canon. Do you think it's a book that's been overlooked, a book that deserves a bit more attention than it's received, or perhaps you think that it doesn't deserve the attention we're giving it here today. Now, let's go into the family and get a family insight into all of this. Elizabeth Stead is Christina's niece. Elizabeth knew Christina as Peg. Elizabeth is herself a novelist, and she celebrated a very significant birthday last week. Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. 21st of June, everybody remember that, 80 years old. And you just got me in time, I think.
I don't say that. Now, you didn't know Christina Stead, but you knew her father, who's your grandfather, that's David Stead. Yes. And like Sam in the novel, David Stead was a scientist. What kind of man was he?
What kind of man was he?
Yeah.
He was crackers.
How?
He was very eccentric. He was very clever. He was very, very, very handsome. All the women loved him when he was young. He was like a blonde god look. It was quite extraordinary. When I wrote I wrote a book called The Fish Castle years ago, because after reading The Man Who Loved Children, I thought, gosh, that was a savage book. And it did upset a lot of people in the family because Peg used real people. You know, it was absolutely true what she said in that book. And I wanted to sort of make it sound, because I loved my grandfather and I wanted to make it a little bit kinder. But as I progressed and now that I'm older, I don't blame her one little bit for being savage. The poor thing lost her mother, as you know. You will all know. You're all academics. You know that she lost her mother when she was just a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And she hated her stepmother, Penny. And I knew her too. We knew her too. She lived with us when she left my grandfather. And it's true. It's ages since I've read the book. I have to say this. But Sam Pollitt is David George Stead. I mean, and the people in it are exactly as they are.
Do we know if David Stead himself ever read the novel?
Oh, yes, I imagine. That's an interesting question. I honestly don't know. He must have read it. I mean, he must have read it. But then an extraordinary thing seemed to happen in the family. We all had the strange names that the Pollitt family had. I won't tell you all of them but Christina was Peg, and he used to call her Peg Leg. And I think that when the book became famous via the United States, everybody started to call her Christina. We all went up a notch.
Right. She became classier.
We all came out of the woodwork and started reading.
You know? Right. Well, good on you, Elizabeth. All power to you, and thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
Elizabeth Stead, and the book that she mentioned there is called The Fish Castle. Darren, what do you make of that? This question of whether the actual father, actually read the book.
Look, I have a memory from reading the Rowley biography that Father did read the book, but I can't remember precisely what his reaction was. But who knows, he might have been quite pleased to have been written up in any form, knowing his vanity.
Yes, what do you make of all this, Fiona?
I'm just trying to remember. I know that Christina had sent Thistle, David George Stead's partner, so his third wife, a copy of The Man Who Loved Children, which she called rather wonderfully a Strindberg Family Robinson, which I absolutely love and I think is the answer to everything. And Thistle had read it and had said, you got it right, but I think it's unkind. And there was a sense in which David perhaps had not read it and never read it. But I completely bow in that to Elizabeth, who may have...
Well, she wasn't sure.
Yeah,
she wasn't sure. I mean, Rowley's very unclear about whether he read it. She treats Thistle as so Thistle's the new wife, basically. Thistle is an amazing name for this woman, because Thistle was a botanist
Yes, Extraordinary Woman.
Was Thistle. We've got some more text messages. Karen says that I read this book in the 1970s when Karen Goldsworthy ran AusLit at Melbourne Uni. Gosh, you're lucky to have studied with Karen Goldsworthy. It opened and enlarged my emotional world, for which I'm grateful. It had a visceral effect on my body. Gosh. A text message from someone who didn't leave their name. I admire Stead's capacity for describing chaos, energy. Sam is like a crazy, chaotic genius, destruction and creation combined. Gosh, that's a powerful text. What about Henny? Let's talk about her. So we've got this wife, Henny, who's sort of the brunt of all this. And Henny and Sam have stopped talking. They only talk when they're arguing. The rest of the time they communicate through the children, which is a horrendous dynamic for a family to have. What do you make of her, Daryl?
Well, sort of the old expression, more sinned against than sinning, perhaps. I mean, I think she didn't know what she was getting into when she married Sam, who had pretty definite plans to subjugate her in various ways. And I think she's just become this harried, monstrous, unhappy, desperate, difficult person. And the children are all suffering pretty clearly from being around her, and she's suffering all the time too.
What do you think?
With Henny, she's a very, very, very interesting character. Randall Jarrell's quite obsessed with her in his introduction and talks about her in this kind of Greek classical tragic way. It strikes me that one of the striking things about Sam is, of course, vitality, his extraordinary vitalist sort of also almost sort of fascist vitalism of Sam, and there's a tremendous vitality to Henny, but it's worked in the negative. So there's some really interesting and complicated and wonderfully un-PC, I think, kind of formulations of how Henny is as a woman in her particular context. It's specific. It's stuff about gender and about reproduction, about family life, about money, and it positions Louis with her not as a supporter necessarily, but somehow as a witness of this sort of subjugation, really, in many ways. But there's an enormous linguistic vitality to Henny, these amazing hag-like bits of ranting, and it's quite shocking and quite energised.
Hag-like ranting, that's probably the most un-PC thing you've ever said in your life.
Probably, yes. Well, I'm quoting Hag from the book, can I point out.
This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. We're talking to Fiona Morrison, who's a lecturer in English at the University of New South Wales, and Daryl Emerson's with us, who's a writer and performer, and we're talking about Christina Stead's book, The Man Who Loved Children, and we do invite you to text us, as so many people have done, or to get on the line and call us. The number for calling us is 1300 22 55 76. 1300 22 55 76. You can text on 0418 22 65 76. Now, on the line is Michelle de Kretzer, a writer and author, and she wrote the 2008 Booker long-listed novel, The Lost Dog. And she's read The Man Who Loved Children many times. Michelle, welcome. What draws you to it?
I think the brilliance of the writing and the fearlessness of it, and because it's the first literary novel that really deals with family life in an intimate way, that's a subject which is now utterly standard for the novel. But before The Man Who Loved Children was published in 1940, no adult novelist had written a book that just focused on family dynamics. That was considered the province of children's literature. And those novels, like Little Women, of course, presented a very sugary version of family life. But Christina Stead was the first novelist to really write about what goes on in families. And this is really a novel about the operation of power within a family. And she was the first person to write about that, which is quite extraordinary.
When you say that, I mean, you're thinking of the family as being parents and little children, because people say, well, you know, Jane Austen, it's all about families. But
it's not. I mean, that's a novel about marriage. The focus of those novels are different. This is really the first time that, yes, about little children and the way and the relationships between siblings and the way a family you know, there is nothing, the way a family operates, there's nothing really of interest in this novel that takes place outside the family. There are scenes where Sam, the father, goes travelling, for instance, and they are the dull passages in this book. Everything that is of interest happens indoors. It happens within the family.
It's a hard novel to read the first time through.
It is. It's a hard novel to read the second time through and the third time through as well, I can tell you that, because it's utterly compelling and it's utterly relentless. And I, for one, have to keep putting it down because it conveys so strongly the claustrophobic atmosphere of family. I mean, we have all felt that when we are young, at one stage or another, that we are being stifled by the family, that we will never escape. It reminds us of our powerlessness when we're children. And it's a hard novel to read on that score.
Thank you for joining us, Michelle.
Thank you, Michael.
Michelle Le Kretzer. And Michelle has a novel coming out in October, actually. It's called Questions of Travel. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN. We're talking about The Man Who Loved Children because it's book club. It's classic Australian book club. Now let's talk about, I suppose, the central character, or the character who's looking at all this happening, who is Louie. What do you make of her, Fiona?
Such an interesting character, Louie. One reading of Louie, of course, is that she's the writer in the making. And that puts her story kind of into a, just to be technical for a minute, a sort of Kunstlerroman, a story of the development of the writer. And here, the story of her development is of resistance and quiet rebellion. And she is trying to make her way, I think, out into the world, which she eventually does. She walks into the world at the end of the work, having survived trauma and abuse. And the way in which she does that is very, very interesting, I think. Both her early writing, the play that she puts on, and the requirement to just resist this completely endless linguistic production of her father. And the way in which she sees very clearly, very early in the novel, sees Henny's position, but in a sense can't help. So she's extraordinarily interesting, I think.
She has some sympathy for Henny, doesn't she, even though Henny's pretty tough on her?
Yes. As early as, if you just go with the Maya Gunya Modern Library edition, as early as, say, page 34, she can see clearly that Henny is behaving appallingly, but that she's also structurally trapped by reproduction, by poverty, by failed expectations. So, it's not exactly a compassionate view, or perhaps it is, I'm not sure. Perhaps that's something that Daryl and the listeners have a view about, that Louie is trying to survive. It's her profound desire is to survive, and she's confronted by the politics that her father introduces, which is that he is both the man with all the access to language and this endless talking he goes on with, but also setting the standards by which she will be judged. And so in a sense, it's an ugly duckling story for her, and his extraordinarily fascistic way of carrying on about female beauty and his requirements of that and how she falls short of that. So there's an ugly duckling possibility with Louie as well. Yeah, Darren. There's a lot to say about her.
Darren. Look, I think just taking up that point about the ugly duckling, I think Hazel Rowley makes it very clear that David Stead was pretty much obsessed with physical beauty, beginning and ending, perhaps with his own, and he felt it was a disgrace to have a daughter who was so plain. He'd apparently carefully chosen, as his various wives, beautiful or pretty or attractive women, and he also seemed to hold the view that ugliness was not only kind of unfortunate but a moral failing. He didn't hesitate to half despise seemingly Christina, but certainly Sam and Lulu in the book, for her awkwardness, ungainliness, large size. And another aspect of that, going back to the question of Lulu and Louisa and Henny, was that one of my female friends said she'd never heard seen in a play where one female character so strongly abused another, as Henny does Louisa at one point. That again is where Louisa is, as does have some sympathy for Henny's position, but in a strange way she records kind of fairly unblinkingly the horrible things Henny says about her. And she's kind of storing up all of these things which become reasons, as Fiona says, to leave and to kind of free herself later on.
Had a text from Helen who says this book was set for the VCE HSC, so that's year 12, in the late 80s. Would be good to know what 16 and 17-year-olds made of it. Yeah, that'd be a tough book to teach at year 12, wouldn't it? I don't know that I'd fancy that. Another text, another listener writes, hi there, I did a whole unit on Stead in the late 80s with David Tacey. So David Tacey teaches English, I think, at La Trobe University in Melbourne. Wonderfully diverse, demanding and memorable. So people with good memories of going to uni and studying. Let's talk about Christina Stead's life. She left Australia in 1928, Daryl. Why? Was she trying to escape her family?
Partly, perhaps. But look, my reading of that would be that, A, she'd fallen in love with a lecturer, I think, in Sydney, who'd gone back to England, and she followed him to see where the affair would go. And also, I think, but beyond that, I think she would came to the point she really just had to sort of fly the coop and try her fortunes elsewhere. And I think an increasing feeling I had about her as I read about her and researched her was that there was, in a strange, she always said she was a lucky person. There was a strange confidence in her in a certain way, a situation that might have oppressed somebody else. She thought, I've got to get out of this, so I'll work doggedly to bring that about. And for instance, she actually saved money carefully to pay for her fare. She took on extra work. She walked everywhere rather than taking the trams, which then ran in Sydney, so she wouldn't have to spend money. So she really planned her escape. Mm. And I think she wanted just to see and experience the wider world.
One thing I wanted to ask you before we wind up, Fiona, is what do you make of the fact that she was required, apparently by her publisher, to set the book in America, even though it is an Australian story? Mm. Since you're not that sold on the idea that we should read this book as a kind of window on her real experiences, are you troubled by the fact that it's been filtered by this American overlay, or is it just that's what the thing is?
I'm not especially troubled. I'm extremely interested in it, and there's a detailed answer to that that may not work now about what it was to be in America. In she arrived in Manhattan in 35, and was immediately in discussions with American publishers. So there's a lot to say about the state of American publishing and what the volume of American publishing and what the American publishers were all doing. It's a very interesting point. I wish we could get slightly better archival evidence on. I would love there to be a letter in the Berg collection at the New York Public Library in which Simon Schuster says in a letter to Christina Stead, you must transpose this, the action of this work, from essentially Watson's Bay in Sydney, where the autobiographical account would lie, to Chesapeake Bay and Washington State. And I haven't found that. And I don't think even David Carter has up at the University of Queensland. So that transposition, I think, doesn't take away from the fact that it is based, I think, very profoundly in her childhood, that she felt able to write, perhaps autobiographically, because of her connections with Ralph Fox and his idea that even if you were on the left, you could use your life as a kind of material for literature. But it also, I think, frees us up to read the book as kind of engaged with the question of America and American politics. So it's a very interesting move, the idea of transposing action so that Americans would buy it. And it's been dogged by, you know, Mary McCarthy saying she's all, you know, terrible.
She didn't get the idiom right.
Voice. Yeah. And but other critics saying, bravo, well done, sounds American to me. So. Yeah. You know, there's some very interesting stuff around all that.
Well, we've got to wind up, but to the listeners who I know will have been engaged by this, do jump online and tell us what you've got to say. Go to the website and we'll read out your responses to this book, because it does require some kind of considered response, I think. But Fiona and Daryl, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Lovely to have you
thank
here.
Thank you.
Fiona Morrison is a lecturer in the School of English Media and Performing Arts at the University of New South Wales. And Daryl Emerson is a writer and performer. And thanks also to Michelle de Kretzer and Elizabeth Stead for their insights. And thanks to you for your text messages. It was great to get so much feedback. The Man Who Loved Children, with those introductions by Jonathan Franzen, the new introduction, and the old introduction by Randall Jarrell, is published by Magunya, but there are other editions as well. Now, our next book club at the end of July is Poor Fellow, My Country by Xavier Herbert, and it's a whopper, so do get reading.